Welcome to Main Engine Cutoff. I'm Anthony Colangelo. This is the road edition of Miko, the second road edition. First one was 085, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago? I don't know. And got a friend here today. You may know him as rocketlaunch.live. Pat, you may know him as the guy that you hear in the executive producer segment of this podcast.
That's right.
You may know him as the guy that you met at the off-nominal meetup in March, or you were that guy in that video of Kerbal Space Academy losing their shit at Falcon Heavy landing.
Did people see that?
Yes. We're going to post that link in the show notes. Pat, how's it going?
What's up, everybody? Good to be here.
So we're on the road back from Goddard Space Flight Center. We are on 95 here, cruising around, and took a little tour through Goddard Space Flight Center, saw some really interesting stuff, and the main meat of it was that we went into the satellite servicing and robotics lab, where they're working on Restore-L, which is the mission that they're going to go up to Landsat 7, refuel it, what else are they going to do to it? Reposition it?
Yep.
And then maybe try out some things about fixing it. You'll hear about that in a little bit. We talked to Brent Robertson, who is the project manager there, and so you'll hear our little chat with him at the end of the show, but we did tour through a bunch of other stuff at Goddard. What were your highlights, aside from the satellite servicing? I gotta remember what we did now.
Yeah.
I don't know that we ever got an actual name of that building, but we went into that control area for where they're controlling a lot of the different weather monitoring satellites.
Yep.
So we had the Global Precipitation Monitoring, GPM is the name
GPM.
Of it? Global Precipitation Monitoring, I think it was. Then we had the Aura, Terra, and Aqua satellites that were all joint there. And then we had LRO is controlled out of there as well. And I'm probably missing one or two, but there was this whole control hallway that had about, they said, some amount of billions of work going on in there at any given moment. That was pretty awesome. We saw some downlink data from GPM. We were there shortly before LRO had its downlink time. General control nerdery, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, this is where the spacecraft are being flown from, essentially. I mean, there's literally a hallway that you walk down that has, on both sides, things like the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Control Center. There are people behind consoles that are looking at the data as it comes off of the spacecraft.
Forget how much is in there, though. Like, that, a lot of missions, not a lot of people. Not today, anyway.
It's amazing how few people are able to be kind of just at the helm of these multi-million-dollar or billion-dollar spacecraft in some cases.
I didn't see if there was a bunch of ICESat stuff up on the walls, but I didn't see if there was a control center there for ICESat, which is launching in like 4 days or whatever from Vandenberg. But I assume that's in there somewhere. And there was a couple other missions they talked about being nearby that we didn't particularly see. There's the Hubble control room at Goddard as well. But I feel like Goddard is probably, either it or Ames are the most underappreciated NASA centers,
yeah,
I would say. That nobody really thinks about how much is going on there. Let's see, what else did we see? We saw a lot of the vacuum chamber testing. Oh, we walked into the centrifuge that they have at Goddard, which kind of blew both of our minds for a minute.
We gotta put the picture, you took a panorama photo, we gotta put that, you gotta put that out there for people to see.
Yeah, so we had Travis, was our tour guide today, and he was like, oh, I want to show you guys the centrifuge. So we're just walking around the high bay clean room, we saw that as well, where James Webb was just hanging out. And then he just walks us into this doorway, and it's this, like, cavernous centrifuge facility that I was not prepared for how large it was inside of that thing.
And they use that for testing spacecraft elements, or sometimes even entire spacecraft, testing the G-loads on it.
He said that most recently they had James Webb components in there, but I don't know specifically what they were doing. And they're they're upgrading it so that it can mimic the loads that are going to be seen in, like, Falcon Heavy SLS launch, some of the bigger new launch vehicles out there. So I wouldn't be surprised to see some stuff heading through there I don't know, he said it's going to be next year that it'll be back online, so maybe we'll take another trip down. He did say that when they start it, it's a gigawatt of power for like a microsecond to get this thing running, and then two people push the centrifuge to get it started. So I asked if Pat and I could be those people next time. He didn't seem thrilled about the question, but he did not say no, is what I would say. Oh, we also saw that static mock-up of W1st. This was a full-scale, one-to-one of the W1st chassis, I would say. People around there was a lot of W1st logos that I saw on the walls and everything, so they're pretty excited about W1st, and I heard from multiple different conversations that the idea with W1st is that more of it would be built and run by NASA themselves, not by a subcontractor, for no apparent reason. There is no reason that they would do that, make that decision to change the next space telescope. We did walk through some of the high bays and clean rooms that James Webb... We didn't walk into the clean room, don't worry. Still clean. We saw some of the high bays where James Webb used to sit. You saw it when it was actually there
I did,
a couple of months back.
In all its glory.
But that is now out at Redondo Beach, I think it is still, where they're shaking the bolts off it and stuff. I don't know. Still an engineering article there, so I kind of got to sense a little bit of the scale of that thing, which is cool, but that's James Webb. We don't need to go too much into it.
Well, they say it's the largest clean room of its class in the United States and possibly the world. So the clean room itself is a sight to be seen on its own.
It
was.
So, it had like a vehicle assembly building vibe to it. The proportions of it, you know, the general shape of it, which, now that I am thinking about that, that is a ridiculously large clean room. So that's cool. I don't know what's going through there next, but whatever it is, I think I'll take a trip down to see what it is, because it's pretty special to see something in there. There was, so let's talk maybe a little bit the satellite servicing, just Restore L stuff before we talk to Brent. We saw a lot of hardware that we couldn't take pictures of a lot of things because they're working out a lot of these components. And as you hear in the interview, the idea here is that NASA at Goddard is developing the payload technologies that will fly on the Restore L bus. So they're sourcing the bus from SSL and building the components. So we saw robotic arms and capture mechanisms and tool mechanisms, fuel valves that they're testing. What was your favorite of the toys that we experienced in there?
I mean, I think it's cool that they are looking ahead and trying to develop a common fuel valve, trying to standardize so that spacecraft in the future can be serviced more easily, because as you'll hear, they have to go through a lot to get into Landsat 7, because it's not designed to be serviced. So that was cool. I think that was cool to see.
I didn't realize that they were actually going to be using the same fuel valves that it was originally fueled with.
Yeah.
Like, they're literally going to have this robot cut into the blankets and unscrew the caps from the fuel valves that are on the spacecraft. And then I think he talks about this in the interview, but he was talking about how they have to unscrew these fuel caps and then catch them before they float away so that they can screw them back on later. So I didn't really... I heard other things about how to refuel, like, satellites that weren't ready to be refueled, and none of them said, make a robot that can unscrew fuel caps to refuel them. So that was kind of mind-blowing. The manipulator system on Restore L, obviously these were, like, engineering models, so I don't think we saw every little detail. And I know they did put a lot away before we even entered the room. There's a lot going on that little manipulator. There's, like, 4 or 5 different tools that I could see visibly. I'm sure there's a lot more than that on there. So that's kind of amazing yet terrifying that there's that much complexity in this little manipulator system. But it's very cool to see the mock-ups that they have. They have a mock-up of Landsat 7 in there that they're testing on. They have mock-ups of the capture mechanisms that they're going to test on, these fuel valves that I'm talking about. So they have this entire, like, simulation area complete with these workstations that were, like, what was it, 8 monitors on those workstations with joysticks and keyboards. Really cool to see, like, where people work on this kind of stuff. So that's pretty special. I don't know if there's anything else that you want to get into before we get into the interview.
No, sir.
But before we do, we do need to say a big thank you to everybody who supports at patreon.com/Miko. Pat right here sitting next to me is one of them. But since he's with me, he's going to read the list for today of these people who produced this episode of Main Engine Cutoff.
This episode of Main Engine Cutoff was supported by 221 patrons and 36 executive producers: Chris, Pat, Matt, George, Brad, Ryan, Jameson, Nadim, Peter, Donald, Lee, Jasper, Chris, Warren, Bob, Russell, John, Maurice, Tyler, Joel, Jan, David, Grant, Barbara, Mike, David, Mintz, Eunice, and 8 anonymous producers. Thank you.
Isn't that hard? That's harder than it sounds, right?
It's pretty hard. I lost my breath. So.
Thank you guys so much for supporting this episode. You make trips like this possible, as well as Pat. So, oh, this is another thing. Everybody head over to Twitter, twitter.com/spacepat_O. That's right, right?
That's right.
Tweet at him and say thank you for getting us into Goddard Space Flight Center, because Pat made this happen.
It's Travis. Travis is a good friend of mine, and all thanks should go to him.
Well, but this was a team effort, and all of you out there at patreon.com/Miko helped as well, so thank you. With that, let's get into the interview, and hope you enjoy. All right, we're here with Brent Robertson in the Satellite Servicing Robotics Lab. We're looking at Restore L hardware all around us, Landsat 7 mock-up over there. Could you tell us a little bit about Restore L, both the mission in general and then where things are at today,
sure.
Timeline, that sort
sure.
of overview?
Yeah, sure. So Restore L is a satellite servicing mission. We're going to demonstrate satellite servicing of what we call legacy satellite, a satellite that hasn't been designed to be serviced. Restore L is going to rendezvous with that satellite, inspect that satellite, capture that satellite. And then we have 2 robot arms on our mission that we will use to service, perform teleoperated servicing of that satellite, including refueling. You know, because this satellite wasn't designed to be serviced, we have to do a number of operations, including, cutting MLI blanket away to get to the fill and drain valves, cutting wires, unscrewing valves. So it's a fairly complicated set of operations we need to do. But we're currently in development. The technologies required to do this mission are nearing completion right now. We've had our preliminary design review last year. We're working towards coming up with a critical design review. This spring we'll have our mission critical design review. We're in the midst of testing our engineering hardware. Getting ready for this mission. We plan to launch it in 2022.
And is the flight hardware still yet to be fabricated, or is that somewhere else being worked on?
Well, in some cases, some of this flight hardware, we have long lead procurement times. In some cases, it takes a year from receipt of order to actually receipt of the hardware. So in many cases, we bought flight parts already. We haven't assembled those flight parts yet, but we bought many of the parts that need to be assembled. And in some cases where, we contract with various industry for components, for cameras, in some cases they've started assembly of those flight cameras already.
And I assume launch is in the same kind of spot where it's not yet been contracted out, but
right.
Is that going to be the NASA Launch Services Program?
Yes.
Something in that
we're
vein?
We're planning to use a Launch Services Program provided by Kennedy Space Center
okay.
To procure a launch vehicle. Launch vehicle hasn't been procured. We will be launching from Vandenberg Air Force Base, but it's yet to be determined what rocket we'll be riding on.
One thing Pat was curious about, we were talking on the way down here, was how Landsat 7 was chosen as the target. There's maybe something going on behind the scenes decision there, or is it just that it's an older satellite that is a good target?
Yeah, I mean, basically, we will be demonstrating satellite servicing for the first time. Many things for the first time. We'd be refueling a satellite for the first time. We'll be capturing a satellite that wasn't designed to be captured. So you don't necessarily want to practice doing that on a live satellite, right? One that's still producing data. So Landsat 7 was basically chosen because it's nearing its end of life. It's running out of fuel. And it is a good representative satellite of other satellites. It has a standard Marmon ring that interface that many other satellites have. So it was chosen for those reasons.
Could you talk a little about that capture mechanism, so people can visualize how that's going to work, where things are positioned, how it will grapple onto it?
Yeah, sure.
Attachment mechanism.
Yeah, the capture is actually one of our most complicated operations that we have to do on RestoreL. So we rendezvous with Landsat 7. We'll come closer. We approach Landsat 7, and that's all ground controlled. But at some point, when we get about 1.5 meter deck to deck separation, we're ready to capture it. And due to the delay in space to ground delay, we can no longer control that on the ground. So the spacecraft has to be smart enough to perform that operation autonomously. So once we give the go for grapple, the spacecraft will approach the remaining distance to Landsat 7, reach out with one of its arms, and grapple the Marmon ring. So that's the interface that Landsat 7 had with the launch vehicle. All satellites have some interface with their launch vehicle. Landsat 7 has a Marmon ring. And you can think of it as just a ring going around at the back end of the satellite. We have a gripper tool that will be attached to the end of our robot arm. And as we reach out with that gripper tool, we have to grip that Marmon ring within seconds of making contact with the Landsat 7 Marmon ring. As you can imagine, in space, as you touch something, it's not going to stay in place. It's going to move away from you because you're actually pushing it away. So we push through the grapple. As we reach and make contact with the Landsat 7 Marmon ring, we'll push through and then grapple within seconds to capture it.
Back to Landsat 7 as far as, I know that it's got the scanline converter issue. It kind of brings up a different question. Is there any opportunity to use something like RestoreL or whatever might come after RestoreL to repair broken satellites?
Exactly.
And does that have anything to do with Landsat 7?
Yeah. I'd say the satellite servicing is really in its infancy as far as seeing the benefits of satellite servicing. NASA's working on a mission, RestoreL. DARPA is working on a mission. Industry, there's commercial efforts ongoing to provide satellite servicing. We have a lot of capability on RestoreL where, we can service Landsat 7, but we can do other things with robots in space, right? You can think of course, we have an ability to inspect satellites. So we can approach satellites if a satellite has something wrong with it. Say an antenna didn't deploy for some reason. We can inspect and understand what happened to that satellite. Then we have robot manipulators. We can potentially resolve an anomaly. We can unstick antennas with our robot arms. We can grapple that satellite and unstick things with the other robot arm. We can replace components on satellites. So satellite servicing allows you to not only repair things, but you could imagine bringing up a component and replacing an older unit or a failed unit on a satellite. These satellites are very expensive. Launching a satellite is very expensive. So people are realizing there's a business case commercially for prolonging the life of these very expensive satellites, either repairing them or prolonging their life. And then there's other areas too that satellite servicing can enable. You can think of orbital debris is a big problem in space right now, right? Well, we have the capability to capture things and deorbit them, right? So you could think of, well, maybe in the future we're going to have a number of satellite servicers in space just taking care of that orbital debris problem for us. And then other things you can think of, most missions are all missions today are limited by the launch vehicle fairing size, right? You can only fit as much into that launch vehicle fairing. That's what you're going to launch. That's what you're going to operate. Well, now if you have robots in space, you can think of, well, hey, I can have multiple launches and I can assemble things in space, right? I can build bigger things, much bigger than are limited by the launch vehicle fairing. So it enables new missions, new mission concepts.
The fueling interfaces that we saw a little display of seems like a little bit of a trouble spot on this mission as well, because it seems pretty complex. Was not something they were thinking of back
no,
in the 90s.
Not at all.
So what's going on there with the fueling interface, both for RestoreL, but maybe in the future as well, what you would like to see be done differently.
Sure, yeah. Well, for RestoreL, you know, we're demonstrating that we can refuel a satellite that was not designed to be serviced, a legacy satellite, right? And it involves a fair amount of complicated operations. You know, there's thermal blanketing, MLI blanketing, covering up the valve area that we have to access. So we have to actually cut away blankets in space. We have to fly a tool that cuts blankets, right? We have to have another tool that holds that blanket in place while we perform operations. There's wires holding those fill and drain valve caps on, so we have to cut wires. So we have to fly another tool to cut those wires. And then we have to unscrew those caps, and there's actually two caps that you unscrew. When you unscrew those caps, you have to make sure that you can't let them float away in space, so you have to capture them as you unscrew them. So there's a variety of, you know, fairly complicated tools that we are flying on this mission to allow us to do all of these operations. And we'll demonstrate we can do that for these legacy satellites. But you can think of, in the future, you know, we've developed here in the Satellite Servicing Projects Division cooperative aids. From as simple as flying a satellite with a fiducial or a pattern that a robot camera can recognize and allow it to approach a satellite more easily, to something flying hardware where you could fly what we have, a cooperative service valve. So that's a valve that allows you, it's a robot, basically a robot-friendly valve. It allows you to approach that valve. There would be no MLI blanketing cover needed to cover that valve. And there'd be no, it flies basically a quick disconnect, so we'd be able to very quickly with one tool refuel that satellite with one tool.
Yeah,
so
just
so
that like would what's simplify on our cars, things. Yeah. You know, an interface that's
just
common.
It's just a common interface would simplify things. So people are thinking about that. It's something that we promote. We develop these technologies, and then we allow industry. You know, anybody can apply for a license to build these things. We transfer the technology to industry, not after the mission's done, but while we're building the mission. We develop these technologies, and we have a number of, we're very active in transferring and showing the technologies we're developing and transferring it to U.S. industry.
Would those be applicable to spacecraft themselves, or even maybe launch vehicle stages, like an upper stage or something like that, that could be refueled? Is it something that could be used in both ways, or just
yes,
really the bus?
Yeah. I mean, you can think of upper stages are basically spacecraft as well, right? So yes.
So there's no particular fuel requirements on that.
Well, there's different fuel. Different fuels are used. We're demonstrating fuel transfer of hydrazine with RestoreL. We have another mission here in Satellite Servicing Projects Division that the robotic refueling mission, RRM-3, will demonstrate storage and fluid transfer of cryogenic fluids. We're looking at various fluids and the complexities of transferring those fluids in space.
What can you tell us about, you guys have, I believe, some hardware that's on the ISS currently?
Yes.
And then I know that you have some with RRM-3 going up soon as well. Can you talk about both of those?
Yeah. So, you know, we build upon, you know, the satellite servicing is certainly, we have the technologies today to do satellite servicing, but we build upon basically the work done by others. So you think back to Hubble Space Telescope, the servicing of that by astronauts, the tools developed for that servicing of Hubble Space Telescope were done. That tool development is done by the same people that are in this division today working on RestoreL. So we build upon that experience, those technologies. We have another mission, Raven, that's currently flying on Space Station. It was launched a couple of years ago. It's an attached payload, and it images all of the cargo supply missions that come to resupply Space Station. Anything approaching Space Station is imaged by that Raven. So it has cameras, it has the algorithms required to do relative navigation computation as those spacecraft approach. And we use the same type of vision cameras and algorithms for satellite servicing missions such as RestoreL. So we certainly build upon, you know, previous missions.
You also mentioned that the part of RestoreL is going to reposition Landsat 7 as well, that's going to change its orbit. What are the details on that?
Yeah, so again, it's... You know, you can think of if you capture a satellite, we fly a lot of fuel on a RestoreL. So we have the capability, once it's captured, we actually capture it with an arm, and then we berth it onto a berthing mechanism. So we have three posts that capture the Marmon ring interface of Landsat 7 to make a rigid connection between us and Landsat 7. And then we're basically in control of that satellite. So we use our propulsion system to boost the orbit of Landsat 7. And we could do this to any satellite, right? And you could potentially give a satellite years of life by doing just that one orbital adjustment maneuver.
Even without refueling.
Even without refueling. So there's a lot of different mission concepts. You know, we're going to demonstrate refueling. Other mission concepts are you just actually attach yourself to a satellite and provide the orbit adjust capability for that satellite.
And that's what now Northrop Grumman is working on with the mission extension vehicle.
Yep, exactly.
Do you have any interaction with that team?
We do. You know, we transfer our technologies to industry, so we're actively talking with Northrop Grumman, with other industry leaders that are working on satellite missions. We make our robot technology available to them so they can use it for their missions. We collaborate with DARPA, who's also working on a satellite servicing mission in GEO. So we're active in promoting the technologies. You know, NASA doesn't want to be in the business of servicing commercial satellites, right? We want to promote this industry, but we really want to see commercial industry take this over. It's apparent that it's going to happen, right? We have Space Systems Ural working on missions. They're working with us. They're working on their own missions. Northrop Grumman. You have European commercial efforts and startups. You know, we'll be one of the first missions to perform satellite servicing, but it's going to become the norm, you know, in the next decade.
RestoreL, after it finishes Landsat 7, is there any projected mission beyond that, or is that yet to be seen with how it goes?
Right now NASA has not determined what we'll do with RestoreL. We have a lot of capability. As I said, you know, we can do anything from we could demonstrate in-space assembly with RestoreL. You know, you could, for instance, launch what we were talking about, a persistent platform, right? You launch something else, and maybe it comes up with a tool, right? And RestoreL goes, rendezvous with that, says, oh, thanks for that tool. I needed that tool to help assemble you. So I'll grab that tool and assemble what was launched. And then something else comes up, and we rendezvous with that, and we assemble it. So something that could be done with RestoreL.
Yeah.
Or we could go, you know, do the same type of thing we're doing with Landsat 7 to other satellites.
So does RestoreL have cooperative fueling valves on it itself?
We do have cooperative servicing valves on it to allow us to refuel the hydrazine, yes.
The camera units on RestoreL, even that alone is kind of an interesting service to be able to inspect satellites.
Yes.
Maybe, you know, somebody calls you up and say, hey, something happened to my satellite. I don't know what exactly.
Yeah.
Do you see that as something that could be a viable service?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, some of these satellites are high value, right? $1 billion, excessive $1 billion to build that satellite, to launch that satellite, right? And basically, you know, the norm to date has been you launch something, it operates in space, and you have one chance to make it work. And basically, it's got to work when it gets into space, right? Well, this is kind of breaking the paradigm. Having satellite servicing allows you to, if there's something wrong, you know, now all of a sudden, you can take that satellite service vehicle, this robot in space, and understand what happened in space, do the inspection, do the anomaly resolution activity. So certainly I could see that happening as well.
One last question I have is how you ended up here. I'm curious about, was this something that you've always been interested in, or you've kind of, you know, as the industry is headed this way, you were like, oh, that would be a fun project to latch onto?
Yeah, you know, I just love working at NASA, right? I love building things. I love managing things. I love working on things and getting to see things launch. So I've worked on a number of scientific missions. You know, this will be my first robotic servicing mission. It'll be NASA's first robotic servicing mission. So I'm just blessed to be part of this, and you know, I just think I have a real cool job.
We do too. That's why we're here. All right. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Sure.
So that's it for us today. Thank you again to everybody at Goddard Space Flight Center who had us down there. Thanks to Brent for spending some time with us talking about RestoreL. Thanks to Travis for showing us around. And thanks, Pat, for getting us in there and for being my travel buddy. So that is it for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.
Take it easy, everybody.